Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 88, section 2, which is old single column, page 968. Okay. So we just got, started, through the first section of this paper and a little preface. If you look back, you'll see that first section is just entitled Belief in Fetishes. Then we're going to go into the evolution of the fetish next. So we introduced the concept of the fetish, and now we want to elaborate on that a bit. Recall that the key thing that we're doing is going all the way back to the beginning of the evolution of religion and sweeping through the whole long, complicated story yet again, this time with an eye to not just, say, the general concept, like in the first paper of this block, that they're worshiping whatever. That specific issue of exactly how you think about some of the so-called science of this ghost land, spirit land, human relationship to it, bringing in the concept of the fetish is bringing in a little bit more technical sophistication, if you will, where you're going to bringing in a vast amount of complexity of new objects that that you have that are reverential points of interest, or a point of focus. So there's that. You're going to be, all kinds of different things, not just a simplicity. Before, it's like, well, we had rocks and we had hills and we had trees, say, and whatnot. But now we can have just about anything, including things that are quite abstract, like a day or a number. The humans are introducing the idea that you could take this object, even if it's quite abstract, like a numeral, and think of it as being literally possessed by some spirit being. So that, like, for instance, remember they pointed out, it's one thing in a very, very primitive state to have some reverence for some mountain, just because, wow, look at it, it's grand and big and awesome. But you bring in the concept of a fetish, okay, and then it's not just any mountain. You're going to, you might still stand in awe of the majesty of a run-of-the-mill mountain, but if there's something extraordinary about the mountain, like every once in a while it erupts, it's a volcano, right? So it isn't just sitting there doing the basic things that mountains normally do. It's doing something, out of the ordinary. You're now going to rationalize that, there's, unlike that normal mountain, this mountain has a being that's taken possession of it. And that's why there's this non-ordinary behavior, because when some spirit being is possessing it, they're very fickle. You never know what they're going to do. No one can predict whatnot, right? So you're going to start rationalizing everything out of the ordinary as the doings, of the of the fickle spirits. And, you know, very few things are just going to be taken as matter of fact. Right? If anything, you know, interesting is happening, you're always going to be suspicious. You suppose maybe a spirit has possessed that, and that's the reason why there's this curious behavior going on or whatever. Okay? And so remember, as they were giving us the basics of that, you know, new concept, we were struck by just how incredibly extensive this is. I mean, how well it caught on, this concept, and it made it so that all the way up to today, even if you by no means are thinking in a very literal, you know, this table is possessed by a spirit sort of a fashion or something, we speak about things in this mode. Remember I pointed out, you know, when they take those names out of Isaiah to use for the adjutants, spirit of intuition, spirit of understanding, spirit of courage, you know, those terms have a fetish origin, right? You know, when people were using those way back when, I mean, they were thinking literally. You had a spirit being, right? You know, that is the spirit of intuition. You know, if someone displays understanding, it's because they're, you know, manifesting, you know, that spirit of understanding. All right, that's the way everything was rationalized. You know, and we do, you know, we do the spirit of thing all the time. You know, the spirit of the times, or whatever. You know, or you know, there was a great spirit at the party. You know, we just say it, you know, nonchalantly now, but we speak that way because not that long ago, this was all taken very seriously and very literally, right? You know, the bottle of whiskey is a bottle of spirits because there's, you know, there's literally a spirit being, right, that is responsible for, you know, that substance producing non-normal behavior. Anything out of the ordinary is being explained in that literal fashion. And so, you know, remember we just, every time, you know, we were unpacking a paragraph, it was a whole bunch of new things. We go, oh, wow, I never thought about it literally like that. You know, so we're just, we're awash.
Well, that answers it for me. So
it was
a chemical reaction.
Yes, right. I mean, it's you know, like we pointed out, it's really handy to be able to, you know, say, don't look at me. I don't bear any responsibility. I mean, like a human could make something extraordinary happen. We're just, you know, there's nothing fancy about us. Right? That has to be a spirit. The devil made me do it, you know, all that sort of stuff. Right? So, you know, it's... you know, we discovered that when you think about trying to get out of the old wineskin and to try to really start fresh with what the revelation is putting forward, this is going to be an area where you're going to be unwittingly thinking in this mode all the time, right? Just because it's very natural, plus society just conditions you in this mode where, you know, like I said, even though you're not thinking probably literally about this anymore, it's a certain frame of mind that really makes it so you can't get to the truth of the revelation. It doesn't matter how unconscious it is and how much you think, it's like, no, I can, that's not going to be polluting. It does. It just puts you in a mode of interpretation that, if nothing else, you know, in a very direct sense, as you're reading something in the book, like I said, you know, you read Spirit of Courage, it won't even occur to you that you're inappropriately interpreting that phrase. You're ingesting it in that old fetishistic mode. You know, and you're thinking that there's this thing that is possessing you, you know, and you're doing the Spirit of Courage. It's like, no, I'm not. No, think about it. I mean, anyone who's been around the Urantia movement for any length of time has heard this all over the place. You know, there isn't the recognition that, no, those adjutants aren't, they aren't beings. They're not entities. Remember, the book even tells you that directly, because they know you're going to interpret them fetishistically. That's why it directly tells you they're not even entities. Right? Think of them as a circuit. It's like, oh, that sounds awfully scientific. Yeah, that's the point. You know, because, no, they're not something that's possessing your mind. They literally are your mind energy. Right? And that's to get to that understanding so that you can properly interpret everything in the book about mind is not natural. You know, and that's why over the years you've heard me stress this stuff constantly. You know, even, you know, reminding you that you can think about the third adjutant, you know, instead of as a Spirit of Courage, think about it more foundationally as the energy of loyalty. Right? Just to remind you that you know, this is your mind. This isn't some influence on your mind. It's your mind. Okay. And that's just a very kind of obvious example. But there's just endless things everywhere in the book that, you know, until you have this highlighted for you, this whole fetishistic scheme, it's going to slip under your radar. And so you need to really hold that up and really examine how you're ingesting what you're reading. It's like, am I really thinking in that old mode? We'll see some of this again in context, and I can highlight some of these things in a more specific fashion. But let's just, you know, pick that up, pick that spirit up. See, again, we just say that. Pick the spirit of the last session up like that. And let's pick, you know, and let's move forward with that, you know, seeing how they continue to build on that. All right, let's see what they've got here.
2, evolution of the fetish. It was a supposed preference of ghosts to indwell some object which had belonged to them when alive in the flesh. This belief explains the efficacy of many modern relics. The ancients always revered the bones of their leaders, and the skeletal remains of saints and heroes are still regarded with superstitious awe by many. Even today, pilgrimages are made to the tombs of great men.
Okay, see, so, you know, here's an obvious example. You know, and you might be saying, okay, well, not only do I not, you know, believe in fetishes in some literal sense, I don't take relics literally either. Yeah, but I'll bet you made a quote-unquote pilgrimage, right, to this tomb of a great man at some point. Right, and if not, if it wasn't literally his tomb, it was some kind of a shrine, like the Lincoln Memorial, right? The Washington Monument, right? Something. You know, you'll see that they'll start to bring out that sort of stuff when you go from the, from church to state with this fetishistic concept. But you're going to have to challenge yourself, see, is what they're saying, to not do what's natural when you're standing there looking up at that wonderful, massive statue of Lincoln, you know, and the majestic carvings on the walls to either side of you when you're in the, you know, in the memorial. You're going to have to challenge yourself to not be in the spirit of fetishism, and again, pun intended. Right? When you're there, it's going to fire your sixth adjutant. You're going to be in a reverential mode. And you're going to overplay that. It's not that you shouldn't respect him and what he did, but challenge yourself to not get sucked into that natural tendency to literally think of it as, you know, the spirit of Lincoln is, you know, possesses this place, and that's why I feel the way I do. Right? You know, that's the way humans have always interpreted that. That emotional feeling was was believed to be the result of a spirit engaging you and making you feel that way. That's why in a religious worship service, right, when you get emotional, right, it's like, why are you trying to get emotional? Because you want to know that the Spirit of God has possessed you and is responsible for that emotion you're manifesting. See? That's the way we've always thought. And the Rancho book is saying, you know, you got to try to challenge yourself. It's not that that's bad. It's just that's child of God stuff. And it's time that some people on this planet started moving towards adult of God. And an adult of God doesn't think that they're emotional because some spirit or God or whatever is doing that to them. Yeah. And you just don't say, I'm in the spirit, when you're feeling emotional. Right? You don't think in that old illusory way. You set that aside as just biology and psychology, you know, physiology and psychology, and you go in quest for a genuine spiritual experience. Right? It's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. Right? There's no spirit responsible for your emotions. You know, it's not even your spiritualized mind that's responsible for your emotions. That's just the fancy adjutant machine stuff. You're looking for something way transcendent of that. Yeah. And you just may not have ever thought about things like it's your thoughts, not your feelings that lead you guided. To think about how a lot of the reason they have to say that is because we have this very strong tendency to think in fetishistic terms. Okay. All right, let's see, what else do we have there? You already saw that they're already setting up the church and state parallels of this, saints and heroes, right? Like I said, we'll get to that more specifically in a little bit. But now, just a little aside, historically, which you may not have appreciated what they're trying to bring out, that those, the little chunk of finger bone or something in some fancy little box, in some, monastery or something somewhere, right? Right. Whatever it is, whatever saint's bone, it is. It may not have occurred to you because you're born post-enlightenment, right, that the traditional person literally thinks, that Saint whoever possesses that chunk of bone, okay? And because he's literally, his spirit is literally in that chunk of bone, that's why you go to it to try to siphon off a little bit of his spirit functioning to, heal your gout or whatever. Okay?
Doesn't work.
I mean, yeah, that's why those pilgrimages, because, it isn't just, totally superstitious. They have a whole science. They have a science that they think that they're engaging. Right? There's a literal effective energy there. You saw the muse. This belief explains the efficacy of many modern relics, right? Okay, so again, just trying to get us into the mode and appreciate the literal foundations of this fetishistic mode of interpretation. And, you know, again, like I said, why will you have a tendency to think in this way? Well, one of the reasons is just about because how literally humans have always thought about this, how real this was, right? The reality of this is in our worldview that we pick up, you know, the moment we start breathing. So it's very difficult. Both nature and nurture get you sucked into this. And to try to somehow hear what the book is saying outside of fetishism is not easy to do.
And trying to talk somebody out of that who believes?
Yes.
Forget it.
It's impossible, basically, yes. See, that's why, you know, I say all the time, so much of the book is for those that, you know, for whatever reason, have chosen to step out of the old mode. They're willing to let go. But if you think that you can somehow go to those who aren't willing to let go and do something or say something so that they'll let go, that's delusional. Right? Besides, you're not supposed to be doing that. They're fine. Right? The book very much is an emergency revelation, a non-dispensational revelation, is very much for those who have chosen to stand apart. And if they haven't taken that first step, you shouldn't be badgering them, besetting them. Okay, let's get a little bit more here.
Belief in relics is an outgrowth of the ancient fetish cult. The relics of modern religions represent an attempt to rationalize the fetish of the savage and thus elevate it to a place of dignity and respectability in the modern religious systems. It is heathenish to believe in fetishes and magic, but supposedly all right to accept relics and miracles.
It's quote-unquote heathenish, right, to believe in fetishes and magic, but all right. You notice that, you know, what they're saying. It's,
you're crazy. Yeah.
Right? It's not just right, it's all right, right? To accept relics and miracles, you know. And of course, between the lines is ouch, right? You know, and again, try to get someone to not fixate on miracles or even to think of the things in part four about Jesus in the old mode, in the old magic mode. Doesn't matter how many times they say, there's nothing magical going on with Jesus. You know, the loaves and fishes has zero magic. Doesn't matter how many times you know the book says that. Everyone, you know, they're in that old interpretation. They see it mentioned in this book. It just affirms that old interpretation. It doesn't reveal anything to them. Right? It affirms that magic is real. Right? And so it's very difficult. And see, and again, it's like, oh, you sound so scientific. You're trying to devitalize my religious beliefs. Like, no, I'm trying to actually get you to real religious beliefs. Right? And until you have real science, you can't have real religion. Right? Until you set all matter aside, you can't get the spirit. And hence, you can't get the real religion. Right? You don't have a religion of the spirit.
And they say the only real big miracle was the fact that Michael was alive inside the... Jesus.
Right. Now, the fact that you mentioned that, you go, well, wait a minute, the revelators, why did the revelators use the word miracle then? Well, they explain that. If you remember, there's a spot when they very precisely tell you, okay, we're going to use your word, but it's a science word now. It's a science word that means The specifics of the physics are not understood. It's not, but it no longer is a word that means there is no physics. It's magic. That's not what the word means in the Urantia book. See, it means the opposite of magic now in the Urantia book. It's like, well, they should have stressed that more, shouldn't they have? It's like, well, you know, it's up to you whether or not you get out of the old wineskin. You know, those sorts of things are a great example of, it's like, well, they should have that at least 100 times. It should say that. It shouldn't say it just once, hidden in some place that I don't read very often. Well, again, just because it says it once in some, you know, oddball place doesn't mean it's any less important than anything else in the book. You've got to notice those little details. Okay.
It does the opposite, though.
Yep.
It kind of explains the miracles. Yeah. The healing, how it was, these beings went in.
Again, the midwayers, a lot of times, they don't understand the physics of it. So they can't even really kind of, you know, a lot of times, you know, they don't even really kind of know if it was something that he was directly involved in or not. You know, we've been going through some of the some of part four on Symmetry of Soul. You know, I've been trying to help with some of those. You know, there's lots of fancy things that happen in the block of papers that we're reading. You know, and to try to say, okay, is this one where the fact that Jesus embodies power personality synthesis deity, you know, supreme type deity, is that the reason why this fancy thing happened? You know, so that, you know, he's literally the power being involved. Or is it not that, you know, is it just, you know, he is making an order and, you know, master physical controllers and life carriers and whatnot are sweeping in and rearranging molecules, you know, or what? You know, and the interesting thing is, occasionally, it's a complete mystery. The midwayers are at a loss. You know, so there's nothing in the book where you can even attempt to interpret it, you know. It's just like, well, okay. You know, so there's lots of mystery. Right? There's a whole spectrum of, you know, kind of immediate mystery and deep, deep mystery on the other end of the spectrum. But nowhere in that spectrum of mystery is there magic. Right? It's all science. It's just science that, you know, I can't give you the equations for right now. You know, incarnation has a science to it, right? It's a mysteries of mysteries science or physics, right? But there's no magic there.
Kind of like one of the things I'm not really interested on is it's like kind of a mystery to me. I kind of hold on to like a fetish with some of these things with spirits because, for instance, I had my shoulder surgery like 2 years ago, right? And they put me on like really strong medications for the pain, right? Well, I started like feeling like while I was on medication, like there's a spirit in a room with me, right? And it seems very real,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I know that there's this drug, obviously, and I don't drink alcohol either because when I do were to drink alcohol, like an after effect would be I would get that same feeling,
mm-hmm.
and I would feel like
mm-hmm.
like there was magic going on,
or right?
There was some
right.
kind of yeah. you know spirit around or something.
Yeah.
And so is my mind. Is it because my mind was kind of adopted to the belief of all this stuff, and then when I'm influenced by something, that influence is bringing that out?
Or? Yeah, well, it's twofold. Like I said earlier, there's a nurture element to it,
yeah.
is what you're referring to.
Yeah.
You know, we're just kind of inculcated into this mode, and so, you know, if you're in a state where you kind of lose your objectivity a bit and you kind of just become a subjective phenomenon, you know, you naturally will interpret in that mode. But, you know, it didn't start with nurture. It's not like beings came down from heaven and nurtured us like this. I mean, it has a nature root to it. It's just the natural way that we are inclined to rationalize our experiences. It just will seem to make sense to us naturally. It's just the way our minds function. And that's just inescapable. And, you know, that fancy phrase, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. In other words, you know, the way you develop as an individual is in parallel to the way things, you know, the collective evolved over a long span of time. Right? You can't help in your development from single-celled organism to mature adult. You can't help but go through the basic evolutionary steps that mankind has gone through over the last million years. It's just innate in the way we're hardwired. You know, we've seen that a lot. The whole ghost cult thing. That's just inescapably natural. Every single planet inescapably has the ghost cult to begin with, because material mortals can't do anything but think that. It's inescapable. Fetish is, you know, is the same way. It just feels right, quote unquote, right, to approach this. And like you're saying, you might even be able to focus in on some specific experiences that you can be very suspicious. You know, I'll bet you that was kind of key a million years ago. Primitive beings, you know, having basically that experience I just had, and it's like, man, it just seems so natural to think of it fetishistically. They obviously were right there too. You know, you can be very suspicious of certain kind of key things that you find yourself just, it's like, whoa, that just feels like real. That is real that way. Okay, yeah. So, right, that's why, you know, why I was stressing. This is so difficult to not do. And then you add on to that, when you interpret things this way, you get a positive feeling about it, and you like that feeling of understanding it that way. And so you don't have any incentive to think some other way. He's like, well, I don't want to think some other way. I really like how I feel when I think of it this way. A revelator, you know, and as I'm trying to give voice to the fifth epical revelation, all that can be said is, yeah, I know. It feels wonderful to think about it that way. But there's a feeling that's even greater than that feeling that's possible. That it's a feeling that results from thinking about it, interpreting your experiences in an even higher mode, a mode that you haven't tried before. You won't leave feelings behind. You'll always have feelings, but these feelings will be not just in and of themselves. They will be feelings that result from a very high functioning of mind and the shadow that's cast down to the level of the feelings. Right? It's like the difference between the genuine feeling that you have associated with happiness, or the feelings you have associated with genuine happiness, I should say it that way, in contrast to the feelings you have associated with joy. Joy is a sublime feeling. You know, it produces a sublime feeling. You know, it's a spiritual feeling, definitely. You know, genuine joy. But there's an even more transcendent feeling that the revelators say humans know almost nothing of. There is a feeling that results from a higher phenomenon that is appropriately called happiness. Genuine happiness is something that is completely transcendent of animals. No dog can be happy, really. And the degree to which you think that is the degree to which you are bounding yourself away from this experience that very few humans have ever had. Something way transcendent of joy. You know, it's an incredible feeling where, you know, despite everything that would make you feel sad, you don't feel sad. You've taken a hold with your free will, of your mind, and you put it in a positive state despite a negative stimulus. And the more harsh the negative stimulus, the more sublime it is when you have a positive state in spite of that negative stimulus. And the feeling that you get when you know you're not a helpless victim, it's incredibly empowering. Right? And you know, you will never be satisfied with joy again, mere joy. Just laying out in a unity bliss state and, you know, and feeling joy. You'll want to take command, you know, of your mind so that you can feel this transcendent feeling. So, but it's, you know, and if someone has experienced it, you don't need to explain. And if they haven't experienced, there's nothing I can say to convince you that there is such a feeling. All I can suggest is, leave yourself open to the possibility that you haven't found the ceiling yet. Keep searching for ever higher ceilings. You'll be amazed at what you might discover. All right. We are nothing but tangents tonight, aren't we?
Same last week.
Like I said, it's an important thing. I want to really stress this because I'm interested in, you know, in putting the challenge that the revelators, you know, are putting forward in front of you. Okay, so just the other little thing before we continue, just, you know, notice how they said the attempt to rationalize the fetish, right? As humans go forward, this whole evolution of the fetish, right? There's gonna be more and more of a rational mind being brought into play. So it's gonna have a precise dot to dot to it. It's gonna be a quote unquote science to it. It's not gonna be a true science, but there's gonna be a science to it because it's gonna be rational. You know, in that sort of minimal sense. It won't be reasonable, right, but it will be rational. Okay. And it definitely won't be logical, okay? But it will be rational, ever more so, you know. And you know, you know the tensions that developed during the three centuries of the Enlightenment as science really kind of started to get going, and the rationalization engine was really getting cranked up. Religion was trying to keep a pace, and so they were trying to get fancier rationalization schemes to parallel the ones that, you know, Newton or whatever was dreaming up. And you know, so it reached a fever pitch of trying to convince ourselves that this isn't just superstition. Yeah, but as they say there at the end, but supposedly, all right to accept relics, and right, they're reminding you that, yeah, just because it's rational, intensely so, doesn't mean it's reasonable, doesn't mean it's logical. And you need to challenge it more. It's like, well, there's no way to make it reasonable. Yeah, so let's just push that away. And let's find real religion, which is reasonable and is logical. Okay.
The hearth fireplace became more or less a fetish, a sacred spot. The shrines and temples were at first fetish places because the dead were buried there. The fetish hut of the Hebrews was elevated by Moses to that place where it harbored a super fetish, the then existing concept of the law of God. But the Israelites never gave up on their peculiar Canaanite belief in the stone altar, and this stone which I have set up as a pillar shall be God's house. They truly believed that the spirit of their God dwelt in such stone altars, which were in reality fetishes.
Okay, let's start with the last little bit. If you don't recognize that, that's Jacob, right? You know, and you know, his stairway to heaven dream. And remember, you know, they mentioned that before in passing. You know, he purposely took a rock and, you know, and laid on it as a pillow because he believes there's a spirit, right, in that rock. You know, and he'd like to draw upon it while he's sleeping. Well, he has this incredible fantasy dream. Obviously, you're thinking, oh, well, he's believing there's a spirit in the rock, and so he's setting his whole subconscious up to fabricate a fancy dream, right? And, of course, that's what happened, right? Something that, you know, matched his expectations about how fancy the spirit was in the rock, you know, led to the fancy dream. And, you know, afterwards, he does that. He sets it up as a pillar. Because, he was suspicious that it had a spirit in it. Well, now he had proof. Because he went literally to spirit land in his dream. All right? So that was proof. There is definitely, God is within this rock. And everyone should, reverence this rock forevermore. So it's a fetish. And like we've joked, you'll go all the way forward to pet rocks. So there's that. Then let's go back to the beginning of the paragraph. Okay, so you have the hearth. See, and again, just think about it. We have central heating and whatnot. Why do we still have a fireplace in a lot of homes?
It's cool.
Right, it's really cool. It's like the spirit of the home, right? Is there in the fireplace and the
charming.
Right? It's so charming. It's charmed. See, right? It's possessed with a friendly spirit. Yeah, So there's that. And then the obvious thing of you bury the dead someplace, and so, right, they're definitely going to be fetish locations. And then if we're picking up between the lines what they're referring to there with the super fetish and stuff. Okay, so you may recall the notion that the Hebrews had was you could set up a so-called tent of meeting. The word that we often use for that is tabernacle. Right, that tent of meeting. And the idea was, like Moses could set up a tent of meeting, and he goes into this tent, this specially consecrated tent, and this isn't just any old tent now. I mean, he literally talks face to face with Yahweh in the tent. It's a literal tent of meeting, right? It's a fetish hut, like they're saying there, right? God is in the tent. Well, then they ramp that, that old notion of just merely the tabernacle, with the Ark of the Covenant. That's the super fetish. Right, where God promises, if you build it just like this, He is going to literally be in. Yahweh is literally going to be in that super fetish. Okay. And you carry that forward, and you eventually build the temple, in Jerusalem. You parallel this whole concept. You would before you had just a tent of meeting, then you had a tent of meeting with the ark in the tent of meeting, and you just put that in stone in the temple. The tent of meeting becomes the Holy of Holies in the back of the temple, right? And the ark is in the Holy of Holies. Right? And you believe literally, not figuratively, it's not just a woo-woo spot, literally Yahweh is in the Holy of Holies, okay? And you could go and talk to Him, okay? You look at the stories with Moses, and they talk about how there's all kinds of a fancy, pillars of, whatnot, with the tent of meeting and stuff. They tell this fanciful, magical story, where it seems like, well, do you need any further proof? He's totally affecting the atmosphere and everything. God is obviously in the tabernacle. Okay, so that's, you know, that's all just, you know, to think about it, and that it's just yet another fetishistic way of thinking about your relationship to God. The entire Old Testament, you know, is steeped in fetishism. That rolls right over into the New Testament. Right? You know, like they pointed out at the end of the preceding section, you know, you end up with the vicar of Christ, you end up with the Pope, you know, and the whole laying on of hands and all that sort of stuff, where literally the Pope has the Spirit of Christ in him, you know, and priests are getting Spirit passed and down from one generation to the next through the laying on of hands.
And the Dalai Lama,
too. And the Dalai Lama is right here. I mean, every culture has that concept. Yeah? And like we saw, sometimes that concept was very closely associated with reincarnation. Yeah? All right, so that you know, that's just the way we've always thought. Yep.
So while we're there's a culture in the ancient worlds where there's temples that aren't fetish objects, but they have a function.
Yep.
And they're important.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, the very fact that there was a temple at the planetary headquarters, you know, say, or a temple in the first garden, or there's temples on the mansion worlds, or whatnot. I mean, see, again, you go, oh, there's a thread of truth to this notion. See, that's... And that the fact that there's a thread of truth, that explains why it's natural that we do this, why we're kind of programmed to interpret things this way, because you start out with a superstitious factual notion, you know, so-called, you know, illusory notion, but there's a thread of truth flowing through it, and you follow that thread of truth forward, and eventually you wrap genuine fact around that thread of truth instead of the illusory notion. That's, you know, you're programmed to pray. And that doesn't mean that you're, you know, the praying of mankind for the first several million years is genuine, you know, in a literal spiritual sense, but it's prayer in truth, even if it isn't prayer in fact. It gets you started, and then it's just up to you to mature from the child that only has the thread of truth, unbeknownst to them, to that adult that genuinely factualizes that truth, right, and sees it with true scientific precision. Yeah,
that's
so.
The same God.
Yeah.
The God of science.
Yeah. Right.
Religion. And
the personal God is the first cause also. Right. Yeah.
What I'm trying to say is it's not one versus the other.
Right, it's not. You know, and it,
because there's, as you say, quote unquote, a scientific explanation, i.e. of physics,
mm-hmm.
doesn't mean that it's not godly.
Yeah. God has a physics. God, you know, the nature of God, right? Physics means nature. That's the physics of God, the nature of God, right? He has a nature. He's not some magical woo-woo notion, right? He's literal. even though he's not physical, he still has a physics. Let's see. I think we got everything else here. Yeah, so... Right, so you like I was saying, it's obviously going to be just hopeless for Jesus ministering, right, to the Jews or even the Gentiles, right, to get them to not think in these material fetishistic ways about what he's saying.
Even today.
Okay, what else do they say here?
The earliest images were made to preserve the appearance and memory of the illustrious dead. They were really monuments. Idols were a refinement of fetishism.
Mm-hmm.
The primitives believed their ceremony of consecration caused the spirits to enter the image. Likewise, when certain objects were blessed, they became charms.
Okay, you know the word idol. This means image. Okay, so they're pointing out that, see, notice how they, where did they, how they say that, that, refinement, yeah. Idols were a refinement, okay? Well, refinement in what sense? Okay, you're, like I was saying earlier, you're introducing ever more precise thinking, you know, and rational, you know, dot to dots with this. Okay, and so, see, you aren't just, just taking some arbitrary stream pebble or something, right? You know, if you're going to reverence Thor, that hero, right? You know, you start with trying to make an image of Thor, as best you remember. And then the spirit of Thor is going to be consecrated into that image, right? So, you know, see, it's actually a step. It's like you're trying to focus your eyes, you know, because like I was saying a little bit ago, you aren't in that, you're going to try to not be in that totally fuzzed out bliss mode. You're going to actually, you know, think about images and trying to, you know, you have to bring your thoughts to a more precise focus. And that's a step forward. Because if you're going to find the real God up on the sixth level of meaning, that God level of God-knowingness, like we've said many times, you've got to have scientific precision focus. You're not going to find him in some fuzzed-out state. You have to bring your mind to a sharp focus. And so this is a step. The concept of you know, not just picking natural objects, but now artfully making an object, and then.
You mean the ayahuasca is not going to do it?
Right. Yeah. And obviously, all of those various chemicals that humans have discovered over the last million years that fuzz out your mind, is not going to get you to God. The more defocused your mind is, the farther you are from the real God. Now, you may find, like you were talking about, you may find what appears to be God because you get in that fuzzed out state. You're very impressionable in that state, and you have all sorts of preconceived opinions, settled ideas, and longstanding prejudices, you know, that will step into that unmolded clay mind you have and mold it into something. And you can have a very vivid experience where you are absolutely convinced that you found the real God. But see, that wasn't the real God. You constructed that. I mean, it's basically an idol. It's an image in your mind that you believe is possessed by the spirit of God. It's technically idolatry. See.
Because it seems so big and complex, like how did I even form that?
And that's why it's so important to remember, see, that it's not really my mind or your mind, yeah. Right? There's just the mind of the local universe, and we're borrowing a measure of it. It's a very, very fancy system, way beyond our limited prosaic experiences. I mean, it has almost, you basically can't put any limits on it. The kind of experience that you can seem to have, not only does it have almost unlimited ability to just mold things with its fancy machinery, but, you know, there's even the technicality that you might be able to actually pull in something. Like, for instance, the Creative Mother Spirit knows every language that's ever been spoken on this planet. And she doesn't forget anything. You could, if your mind is not very, grounded, if it's a little loosey-goosey, you could suck in a little bit of that, you know, and start blathering in some dead language, right? And again, it's not because you're possessed by some being that's speaking that language. I mean, you know, you're just using her mind. I mean, the only reason that you're going to speak some dead earth language and not some language on some remote planet is because your mind isn't that loosey-goosey, right? It's only, you know, loosened up enough where you can pick up stuff, you know, in the immediate range of the mind that's used on this planet, right? The mind that's used on another planet is quite different than here. You got a long mindal journey to get over there, and no one is that untethered. But you can easily be untethered enough to pick up on some genetically similar human that's lived on the planet, or, you know, some dead language or whatever.
It's not necessarily all fabrication. You can also have real experiences with.
Yeah, yeah. And the very fact that you have an adjuster, you know, means there is a point generator sort of in your mind of potential experiences. But like they said, yeah, there's no mystic faculty for you to receive those messages uncorrupted. The moment it puts something out as a stimulus in your mind, that stimulus immediately is reformed to match your worldview. You know, and that's why they say, you know, some of your most poignant, grotesque dreams aren't something that you fabricated it yourself. You know, that little point generator source in your mind, you know, produced this, it's sort of initial vividness, and then you morphed it into some grotesque, you know, form. So, you know, this is, yeah, the adjuster just makes it all the more so that your mind is a very complicated phenomenon, and there really aren't any limits to what might go on in it. You need to be very cautious about running with something there. Okay. You know, but when you're thinking, nope, I'm not fancy at all. You know, as a matter of fact, in the 20th century, scientists told me definitively, I'm just a collection of molecules. I don't even have a mind. So obviously, if anything fancy happens to me, it can't be in my mind. I don't have a mind. I just have a brain. And so if I have some fancy experience, the only way to explain that, even more so in the 20th century and the 21st, is that you are possessed by some spirit being who's playing with your molecules. How else are you going to explain it? If you assume philosophic materialism, fetishism is the only option for explaining anything. I mean, technically, why is my arm moving in front of my face right now? There's no physics equations that demanded it move like this. It can explain the how of its movements, but not the why of its movements right now. Oh, well, I guess technically the only way to explain my hand moving is fetishism. There's got to be a being possessing me because, you know, matter just doing this, that's extraordinary. Matter by itself can't do that. So the extraordinariness of my hand motion in philosophic materialism, again, see, the only way I could possibly explain that is fetishism.
I was wondering.
See, if you take these so-called scientists literally, see, all they've done is they've forced us to have only fetishism for the interpretation of everything. So should you be surprised that they have theories that are based upon magic? No, there's no other option, right? Yeah. So anyway. It just shows you that it can get very, very fancy, but coincidentally, it'll be fetishistic. Because it just isn't, you know, naturally, that's just where you have to be.
Okay. I grew up thinking we could go to Oz and get whatever we needed.
Yeah. Yeah, but there you were told to not mind the man behind the curtain right in the Holy of Holies. Yeah, remember the Holy of Holies is separated by a curtain. You know, if you haven't put the two and two together on that. Let's see here. Let's see. So we get everything there. That's right. Remember, there's this. We have the one other little thing besides fetishes directly. We have charms. You know that. And when certain objects were blessed, they became charms. Remember, we've got that other little kind of side mode to fetishism, where you know it's kind of less. Let's see, less fancy, less focused. You know, it's a little bit more, remember, like that nature spirit kind of fuzzy sort of thing. You know, where it's just some, you know, little bead on your necklace or whatever is possessed by some kind of nature spirit sort of a thing, as opposed to like Yahweh, right? you know, it isn't fancy like that. You know, so that's the whole point of charms, is to have a kind of the simple spirits, you know, fetishism is charms. The fancy spirit fetishism is, you know, is full-on fetishism. Okay. Discount spirits, right? Make charms, yes. Exactly.
Moses, in the addition of the second commandment to the ancient Dalmatian moral code, made an effort to control fetish worship among the Hebrews. He carefully directed that they should make no sort of image that might become consecrated as a fetish. He made it plain, you shall not make a graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or on earth below, beneath, or in the waters of the earth. While this commandment did much to retard art among the Jews, it did lessen fetish worship. But Moses was too wise to attempt suddenly to displace the olden fetishes, and he therefore consented to the putting of certain relics alongside the law and the combined war altar and religious shrine, which was the ark.
Okay, so there was a lot of wisdom in Moses' efforts, like they're pointing out. He knew that he couldn't be total fiat. He had to be, to some degree, evolutional in his approach. And so he's not going to demand harsh, severing boundary lines, and he's going to let things evolve, and he's going to try to nudge them forward. And I remember how you had the seven commandments that the prince's staff put forward, and those carried forward for hundreds of thousands of years, and they just got added to a little bit like this, adding the graven image. One, the second commandment, in the Ten Commandments. And again, you're probably used to, you know, hearing Christians talk about idols and graven images and that sort of stuff, but you may not have thought about it, you know, anthropologically, and recognized it was fetishism. You know, what you were talking about there. Let's see, anything else there? Let's see, you got that. Just the fact that they're using the graven image thing. Does everyone know what you mean when you say graven? Think to engrave something. You know, see, graven. I mean, it means to carve. It's a carved image. You know, like the Norse would carve a Thor image out of wood, right, or whatever. It's a graven image. Let's see, what else there? And obviously, you know, this has this unfortunate side effect that, you know, so impacted Jesus's young life. No graven images, so, you know, you no art. You know, that's an abomination. But it did, in relative evolutionary terms, it was a step forward. It's like, okay, if we have to sacrifice art, now eventually there's going to be Greeks and we can kind of blend the religion of the Jews together with the science and art of the Greeks, and we'll get art again, in Christianity. But they needed you know, to get rid of the fetishism to some degree. Okay, keep going.
Words eventually became fetishes, more especially those which were regarded as God's words. In this way, the sacred books of many religions have become fetishistic prisons, incarnating the spiritual imagination of man.
Incarcerating
the spiritual imagination of man. Moses' very effort against fetishes became a supreme fetish. His commandment was later used to stultify art and to retard the enjoyment and adoration of the beautiful.
Okay, so, we'll continue on this theme here in the next paragraph. See that, but we're introducing this. Remember how we saw that once you have fetishes, it was much easier for mankind to go to much more abstract notions. It didn't have to be some literal object like a rock or a tree. It could be a numeral, or something more abstract. And so words, right, become fetishes. I mean, everyone knows that people talk about sacred books, but have you thought about it literally? Right? When someone thinks that the Urantia book, this book in my lap, is a sacred text, a sacred book, unconsciously, see, what they're thinking is that literally this book is possessed by the Spirit of God. Right? It's a sacred text. And so you have the irony, like they're saying there. So Moses pens the second commandment. Well, eventually, it's not the words of Moses. It's the words of God, right? And literally, right? I mean, you can't change a letter. I mean, that is literally God in those letters. I mean, that's why people, have such a difficult time with different translations. It's like, no, we need to go back to the original, because if you change a word in from the King James, they think that's the original, right? like my favorite thing I always joke about, one time when a church was trying to move from the King James to the Revised Standard as the official Bible. The pastor was going around to try to help everyone with the transition, and the pastor went to this one person's house and was talking about this, trying to smooth the transition, because they knew they were going to have problems. This person was going to have problems with that, and finally the person is just so frustrated, too many words, and they said, okay, if the King James was good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for me. Right. Yeah, okay. Yes. But see, where does that come from? I mean, what gets someone to say such an unreasonable statement, such an uninformed statement? How do they get to that? It's because of fetishism. Right? Definitely from an English perspective, not technically, but from most people's perspective, that's sort of the beginning of the English Bible, right? With the King James. And so they see it as the original from a biased English speaking perspective. And so it is the sacred text. It in its specificity is filled with God, has God in the ink. Okay. And if you change anything, right, you haven't built the tabernacle properly, you haven't built the ark properly, how precise the Bible tells you to build that ark. If it's anything is not precisely like that, God can't fit into the ark. Right? So if you change one letter in the King James, God doesn't fit into the words anymore. Right? It's a very precise thing. It's fetishism. Okay, so that's why people get so serious about this.
But
but you could still have a desire for the original of anything.
Yeah, without, of course. Yes.
Without fetishizing it. I mean, that book in your lap is a first edition.
Yeah, this is a Xerox of the first printing, yes. But I have I have it in my lap for scientific reasons, not for religious reasons.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. It doesn't have to be.
It doesn't have to be, but like I've been saying, that's the challenge. Can you keep it separate, not let the false religious stuff blur in?
I thought it was for philosophical reasons you had.
Well, no, the precise words is a scientific question, right? It's the facts of the words. That's a scientific question. The philosophic part is what you can't read. That's the truth. But the words are facts. That's a science issue. All right, so anyway, back to the paragraph here. The irony. So he pens that, and immediately, in very short order, people are literally thinking that is the word of God, not the efforts of Moses to evolve the people away from fetishism. Right? It's the absolute word of God.
So God took his finger and used it to carve it in.
Well, how does that go? You know, we're about to get to that. Moses was inspired, right? It wasn't really Moses holding the pen. He was inspirited. God was moving his hand. Moses was possessed. You know, when you say a book is inspired, see what you mean fetishistically is that person was possessed and not in control of their hand or their mouth, right?
Which,
right? And that's why the Revelation directly says this is not an inspired text. None of the authors were possessed, okay? And their mouth and hand was moving beyond their control. No.
So when I've done some paintings in the past, if I felt like there was a flow going, and I felt like, afterwards it was like, well, geez, where did that come from?
Yeah.
I mean, I know that artists sometimes feel like that.
Yeah.
When they're doing their work.
Yeah.
How do you think about that?
Right. See, again, it's not that you are literally possessed so that you think of the word inspired literally, but you still use the word inspired. It's like, well, why? I mean, well, because there's a truth to that thought. You have spiritualized mind. It isn't literally a spirit being inside your mind, but it is spiritualized mind, and your creativity is there. You know, your mind is inspirited in that sense, that it's spiritualized mind.
And there is a spirit being.
Right. Yeah, well, not a spirit being, spirit entity. Yeah. See, that's another challenge to not think of the adjuster as a spirit being. You're literally possessed. Yeah, right. It's an entity. It has no personality. But for the time being, just like the Revelators do in the book, instead of coining new words, it's like, okay, well, I'm never going to use the word inspired because that invokes fetishism. That's too cumbersome. So they use the words that we have, a lot of them which are based on fetishism, and you just have to think about them in a non-fetishistic way. You know, kind of like what Shane was saying. You don't have to think about it that way, but you're going to have to challenge yourself because it's going to be natural to think about it that way. And there's even things in the book that make this even more problematic. When they tell you that muses are literal, remember in the Celestial Artisan's paper? Oh my. Okay, that's going to, see, that feeds right into fetishism. And they tell you, yeah, that muse thing is not imaginary. There literally are muses. Oh, well, so every artist is thinking, oh, I literally have a muse from Havona. Obviously, there's problems there. But see, again, it's so problematic. For them to tell us something like that there's literally muses and for us to not just get sucked into errant fetishism, with that statement. you know, not to mention delusions of grandeur. Yeah, so, okay, let's see here.
I want to address that question.
Oh, was there a question that we need to address?
Andrea's wondering if we should be careful in doing translations of the Urantia book.
Well, again, you know, we should be very careful doing translations of the Urantia book, not because the Urantia book is a sacred text and any modification means that God isn't in it. right. The problem is, it's a very, very delicate thing to engage the facts of the words in the English book and try to get out of your old wineskins and get to the truth that's flowing through the text. It's a very, very delicate, you know, issue. And a coarse mind translating the book, you know, that has no recognition of the truth that's flowing through, you know, it's going to be very difficult. You know, then on top of it, there's just technical things. There's a reason why they wrote it in English. I mean, in a lot of other languages, it's impossible to write the Urantia book and have the truth still flowing through it. That language just doesn't allow for a mode of expression that has the precision and stuff. I mean, the polyglot language that is English, you know, has that, has the requisite degrees of freedom. We don't have to go into any details, but, you know, almost every other language has all kinds of issues. The fact that the language is very circumscribed. I suspect that Revelators could have done a proper job, you know, in at least some other languages. It's quite an assumption to assume that any of us, you know, have that sophistication to do that properly. Like we've said many times, translations are
always a work in progress.
Yeah, they're always a work in progress, and they can never be more than a stepping stone. I mean, you really need to get to the English eventually if you're going to get very deep into it. Because there are a lot of very subtle things. I mean, we often talk about, you know, what if your language, all the nouns are capitalized? What are you going to do about the fact that in the English thing, there's a vast difference between a noun capitalized and a noun not capitalized? What are you going to do with that?
Don't capitalize.
just simple things like that. I mean, lowercase s supremacy and uppercase s supremacy are radically different. Not a little bit different, totally different. those aren't synonyms.
Some languages, they don't allow you to coin words.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can't do that. And you can't add other letters, and you can't change it. They're not languages that you're not allowed to change the language.
Yeah, yeah.
They
have language police, yes.
Oh.
Right. Yeah.
I kind of heard the same thing with the Bible. Like, I've heard people that have studied the Aramaic and stuff and have gone back and have read it and that, and they said that you can't even really translate that into English or whatever.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, if you want to get serious about the Bible, it's very handy to look at different translations, you know, and kind of reflect on them together. I mean, the Urantia book, you know, if they quote a certain passage in the Bible somewhere, that's a handy little addition, because you can notice how they tweak it or whatnot, you know. A lot of times giving you hints about, you know, the most truthful way to think about that Bible passage.
And it's steamrolling the fetishized Bible readers.
So. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we could go on about that subject forever. It's a very complex subject. Okay. Let's see. I keep having to come back and make sure we haven't forgotten something here. Let's see. Oh yeah. Anyway, yeah. I was just that point, and then we'll start reading. You know that they say at the end they're about stultifying art and retarding the enjoyment and adoration of the beautiful. It's just that because you turn the second commandment that's supposed to move you away from fetishes, you turn it into a fetish. Right, it's just ironic. Okay.
In olden times, the fetish word of authority was a fear-inspiring doctrine, the most terrible of all tyrants which enslave men. A doctrinal fetish will lead mortal man to betray himself into the clutches of bigotry, fanaticism, superstition, intolerance, and the most atrocious of barbarous cruelties. Modern respect for wisdom and truth is but the recent escape from the fetish-making tendency up to the higher levels of thinking and reasoning. Concerning the accumulated fetish writings which various religionists hold as sacred books, it is not only believed that what is in the book is true, but also that every truth is contained in the book. If one of these sacred books happens to speak of the earth as being flat, then for long generations, otherwise sane men and women will refuse to accept positive evidence that the planet is round.
But then, of course, you know, we have sort of nouveau flat earthers, you know, today. Okay. Yeah, which is an important thing to think about. It's like, how can anyone, again, you can rationalize anything, you know, and just thinking about how, it's like, well, how do they rationalize that away? I can't think of any way I would rationalize that observation away. Well, you're not that smart. Find a smarter person. A smarter person can come up with a rationalization. You always can. You can rationalize anything. That's literal, right? Just like you can believe anything. Right? If you take away all objective oversight on rationalization and belief, right, there are no limits. You can rationalize anything, you can believe anything. And it won't be reasonable, it won't be logical, okay, but it'll be rational. Like I was saying, that fact that, you know, you got people trying to, you know, to bring back flat earth, you know, it's helpful to just, you know, notice that, you know, if you find a clever enough person, they can actually rationalize it. And it's a way of reminding us, like, you know, the next time someone gives me a rational argument, maybe I shouldn't just believe it because it's rational. Right? The next time a politician gives me a rational argument, a talking head on TV gives me a rational argument, a scientist gives me a rational argument, just because it's rational doesn't mean it's true. Right? You need to get above it. Just because it gets the correct answer doesn't mean it's true. Just because it has 50 confirmations doesn't mean it's true. You can confirm false theories. It's helpful to just be reminded of that, because it's so easy to get sucked into it. And it's like, wow, man, they've dotted every I and crossed every T. It's got to be true. No. It doesn't mean anything.
Especially if you're around it. You know? Because if I'm around something more frequent, it starts rubbing off on me. It's like, I got to recheck myself and start being more conscious and try to be above that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because if you don't bring in the three cosmic intuitions, you're a helpless victim of that rationalization scheme. You have to believe it. Right? See, naturally, you can't do anything but believe something that has every I dotted and T crossed. It's unnatural to not believe it. You have to use your upper domain mind, right, to not believe it. Right? It will be inescapably compelling, you know, to your lower domain natural mind. Okay, so Anyway, back to the text here, not to dwell on flat earthers. But, and see, notice how they're, in the middle there when they talk about modern respect for wisdom and truth is but the recent escape from the fetish-making tendency up to the higher levels of thinking and reasoning, reflective thinking, and reasoning, to begin with, and then eventually, full-on logic. But, so again, you need to escape the natural state of fetishism, like I've been saying, and when you follow the thread of truth that's flowing through it up, you get to real things, like wisdom and truth. Okay, but it's not an easy thing to you're going to have a tendency to drag some of the fetishistic stuff up into the upper domain and pollute it, and when you drag religious dogma up there, you pollute the sixth level, and now once that sixth level is polluted with religious dogma, you can never know the real God. Until you remove the pollution on the sixth level that you put there, the real God is not available to you.
They say modern respect for wisdom and truth. Do you think, and this was written in way back when,
right?
Do you think we've slipped back?
Of course.
Don't have the modern respect for wisdom and truth anymore?
Yeah, of course. We're in the deep into the endarkment now, right? Bounded away from wisdom and truth, but it was still there at the beginning of the 20th century, and that's why, when I teach reawakening philosophy, we try to go back and take a hold of what was there and then move up from that, and set aside the endarkment. Okay, now the other thing there is, why did they italicize doctrine? It seems like, is it just because they say it's the boogeyman? Right, the most terrible of all tyrants which enslave men. Is that why they, that's partly why they italicized it. Remember what the word doctor means literally. It means teacher. And doctrine is teachings. Okay, so... that helps you to understand. See, in olden times, the fetish word of authority was a fear-inspiring teaching. Right? See, God has taught us this. When you fully embrace that God has taught you this, it's a doctrine, then it becomes an unquestionable doctrine. It's a dogma. Okay. But it's that fact that it isn't just some guy has said this. We've been taught something, see, through this inspired individual. Okay. Like we often talk about when we talk about Islam, right? That surrendering yourself to the word, the pronouncements of the mullah, right? You're not believing that you should just trust some run of the mill Joe, right? No, Allah is directly, has possessed him and is teaching through him. You believe that literally.
Following doctrine, the most terrible of all times, which enslaved man.
Yeah.
To your point about corruption of the upper domain.
Yeah. See, you've just surrendered your potential free will relationship to the cosmos, right? And you've enslaved yourself. There's still a possibility you can know the truth, and the truth can set you free, right? from that enslavement. And again, like we were talking, we were talking about this last time, when they bring up bigotry, we were talking specifically about fanaticism. Again, when you when you bring the apparent reality feeling of the upper domain into play, you are all the more aggressive in how you manifest in the outer life. You know, this isn't just a thought you have. No, this is reality you believe. And you know, see that that's why they're bringing that. You know, they're reminding you of what we were talking about last time in that regard, because you've made a false reality up there, right? That religious dogma that you drug up onto the sixth level of meaning makes a false god, and it will appear to be a real god, right? It will have the solidity of reality. There's subjectively nothing I could ever say could convince you otherwise. Right? It will feel as real as anything. But you're the author of its reality. Right? That's the tricky thing about the double-edged sword up there. All right, let's keep going. Oh, you got something?
Yeah, speak about the book part.
The sacred book thing?
Well, I mean, it's kind of reflecting me, like, you know, because every word, when you go to church, every word in the Bible is the word of God. It's the same thing about the Urantia book. You know? Mm-hmm. It's eventually going to have that same kind of thing.
Yes.
And if it's not in the Urantia book, it's not real.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Actually, that was one of the things I missed. We need to emphasize that. There was almost an instant tendency amongst those who started reading and studying the Urantia book to unwittingly think of it like they're saying there in that sacred book mode. You know, maybe not literally like, I'm going to call this a sacred text, you know, because, you know, it tells you in various places you shouldn't call it that. But, you know, indirectly they are, because they're thinking that all truth is in the book. Right? See? And that's sacred text thought. That's fetishistic thought. I mean, you know, if the infinite God is in the book, I mean, obviously all truth is in the book. See? That's fetishistic thought. you know, like I've said in just general terms, what you want to start with is the simple thought of half of what you need is in the book. And I often just, you know, analogize it with a sphere. The upper hemisphere that you need is the divine revelation. The other half that you need is the lower half of that sphere, is the human philosophy. That's not in the book. Remember they tell you that if it's something you have or can get, we're not allowed to put it in the book. Just see to bound it all the more away from the sacred text mode. And if you're studying the life and teachings of Jesus, you can't just use part four. That's not everything you need. You also need the Bible. Right? And part four explains you how to use the Bible. You know, how to set aside that which is not, you know, proper, how to tweak, you know, something that's close. But then there's also stuff that, you know, some of the details are in the Bible just fine, and you need to add that to the description that's in part four in order to fully flesh out, you know, what the setting of the scene was, for instance, in some particular, you know, event that happened. Right? They don't repeat everything in the book, you know, even factually, right? So and that's very true everywhere else in the book as well, right? You can't just use this as the physics text or the chemistry text or the paleontology text or the history text or whatever, right? There's half of what you need is not there. It's the bottom-up half. Right, the top-down half, humans can't generate themselves. So it has to be given to us. We're bottom-up beings. We can't generate top-down. The top-down half, the upper half, is the metaphysics. Right? And that has to be given to us. And this is just the metaphysics. Everything else you need to fill in yourself. And then what you're looking for is the super additive consequence, the relationship between the two. Something that transcends even the divine revelation of the text. And you know, so when occasionally you see me saying something very definitively, and you could go, well, where does it say that in the book, Chris? Well, it doesn't say that anywhere. Well, does it say in some other book? No, it doesn't say that in any other book either. But if you take what you know, say, from science, and you combine it with what it says in here, and you get the super additive consequence of the relationship between the two, then you get what I'm saying. Right? It's that's what you're supposed to be doing. Very sophisticated and open to lots of problems, obviously. I mean, that's one of the reasons why people are taught to stay within the lines of the sacred text. Because the smart people that put forward that edict long ago know that if you go outside of the lines, people fly off on false tangents quickly. You know, they're trying to keep the congregation, you know, grounded a bit. But see, you know, if you're going to become an adult of God, you know, you have to take on that challenge to be integrous as you go beyond how a revelation initiates you, initializes you. You have to see to the integrity of what you do beyond that. You have to be ruthless with yourself, right? To stay on line with the truth. You know, you can't just like, oh, that is, I love that thought. I can see that it's not that reasonable, but I that doesn't matter. It's too delightful of a thought to set aside because it's not reasonable. It's very difficult to not think that way. It's delightful, in a genetic way, and you don't want to set it aside. All right. Yeah, thanks for mentioning that, because that's a very important thing. To not, you know, just be stuck to the words that are in this book in my lap. Okay.
The practice of opening one of these sacred books to let the eye chance upon a passage, the following of which may determine important life decisions or projects, is nothing more nor less than arrant fetishism. To take an oath on a holy book or to swear by some object of supreme veneration is a form of refined fetishism.
Okay, just that whole, and people do that with the Urantia book, right? They open it up and read.
Kick in the pen, where are we going to go?
That's fetishism, errant fetishism, like they're saying, right? I mean, it's just, full out and out fetishism to do that. I mean, seriously, think about it. What, why do you think that has any validity? Right? Because you think that the book is possessed by a spirit, right, that sees to where the book opens and knows exactly what you need to hear. It's like, yeah, but I read it. It was exactly, yeah, you can rationalize anything.
Double check my Ouija board, and
my horoscope in the newspaper said the same thing. And you can rationalize anything. And then just you see again. You notice how we're starting to bring in state along with church here. When we get a new president, or even any new government official. Right, they put their hand on a Bible, and a lot of times it's their family Bible because it has the spirit of the family in it, and they want the spirit of the family to possess them, and guide their presidency. Sometimes it's a former president's Bible because they want the spirit of that president to possess them, and guide their presidency. And, I'd really like the spirit of Lincoln to rule my presidency. I mean, I don't want to be the president. I want Lincoln to be the president again. So I will let Lincoln possess me and be president again through me.
That's why I use Jesus' Bible.
Again, it's just...
You said earlier.
It's fetishism, yeah, right? The King James, yeah.
Nobody can argue with that.
Yeah, and of course the fact that basically the fifth epical revelation is using the King James, doesn't that just prove? Yeah. I know, it's just full of pitfalls.
But what you said a minute ago,
yep.
You know, is very interesting to me in terms of fostering the teachings of your answer book on a larger scale, even with the masses of people, as opposed to just the people that are ready for it,
mm-hmm.
or at least the fourth part.
Mm-hmm.
And what it said is that, what you just said to me is that for those people that do have a pretty good knowledge of Christianity, whether, you know, one way or another through the Bible or through other teachings,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be easier for them to pick up on the fourth part of the book and combine it, like it was for me growing up in that situation. Yeah. It just, the two came together.
Yeah.
Whereas without that, you know, without being able to study that or whatever, just the fourth part on its own doesn't really, you know, it's, as you said, it's, they're not giving you anything you don't already know. Or can already have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of helped me a lot, just that thought.
Yeah. You want the super additive consequence of the relationship between part four and the Bible. That's what you're looking for.
Yeah.
Not just the Bible, not just part four.
Or the teachings of both.
Whatever. Yeah, I mean, and just on a simple, you know, immediate basis, I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that are said in part four that are complete, and you're not going to get it at all if you aren't hearing what's in the Bible first and then thinking about what they're saying. They're playing off of what's in the Bible. You know, I mean, it doesn't stand on its own, what's in part four. It's predicated on some thing that's said in the Bible. And if you don't know what's said in the Bible, you don't get it.
About the apostles at all. There's this book.
Yeah.
It gives a whole story.
Oh, of course, you know.
Fascinating.
Right.
And then you get why they acted, who they did, and so on and so forth. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, obviously there's a number of factual things that aren't in the Bible that, you know, are added to the mix here. But, you know, it's important to remember they're added, mm-hmm. right? The part four doesn't replace the Bible. It adds to the Bible.
They say the missing years and things like that. You know?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that Jesus actually ended up being a father even though he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, kind of,
yeah.
That point is important.
Yeah, it's a very important point. And again, it's just, you're one of the reasons you're saying it's an important point because you're recognizing, wow, that doesn't happen naturally. Naturally, there's a tendency to just get sucked into part four and think of it as everything. That's what, see, again, it's not that you're not stupid when you do that. That's just, that's why we were designed. That's just a natural way that a human will engage that, and it's you need to be genuinely human, genuinely unnatural, to properly utilize what's in the Urantia book. Okay, all right, yeah, keep going.
But it does represent real evolutionary progress to advance from the fetish fear of a savage chief's fingernail trimmings to the adoration of a superb collection of letters, laws, legends, allegories, myths, poems, and chronicles, which, after all, reflect the winnowed moral wisdom of many centuries, at least up to the time and event of their being assembled as a sacred book.
I mean, that's kind of just reminding you why you still need the Bible. I mean, all of that winnowed moral wisdom is not in the Urantia book. They don't quote everything in the book of Proverbs, you know, and so don't think that, well, all I need to know is the things that, you know, they do quote from Proverbs, you know, any more than Jesus was saying, now when you write the New Testament and you put down where, you know, where I quoted the Hebrew Scriptures, don't start thinking that you can throw out the rest of the Hebrew Scriptures. All you need is the things that I, you know, pointed to. And of course we often use this wheat and the chaff thing. You know, see, they're doing the same thing. Winnowed moral wisdom, right? I mean, and the Urantia book is fantastic, right? Incomparable, indispensable for separating the wheat from the chaff in the Bible or any other thing you read, your quantum mechanics textbook or whatever you're reading.
Throw those fingernails away then.
Oh, I don't know. That one big, long, curly one, I mean, has so much of the spirit of the king in it. like, you know, that statement, you know, that it, you know, it does represent real evolutionary progress. You know, that's a lot like, it was a huge step forward when they went to slavery instead of cannibalism. Right? Pretty hard to argue with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yep. You got something?
Well, I really like the point they made about at least up until the time it was.
Oh yeah, it assembled. Yes.
because that's something that, as you know, Christian, you know, growing up Christian, you don't get that at all. That it was only up until a certain point. So you. The last 2,000 years or whatever number of years, you don't really get the benefit of.
Yeah, like especially those 3 years of the Enlightenment, or 3 centuries of the Enlightenment, for instance. Yeah. That's painfully obvious that it's, you know, missing from that sacred text. You know, so that you've got, literally what you have is, You've got the plane of the earth, and then there's this dome. And when Jesus ascends into heaven, okay, he's literally floating up from the plane towards the dome, and then a little hatch door in the dome opens, and he goes through to heaven on the other side. Right? I mean, you know, when they're talking about Jesus ascending into heaven in the Bible, it's in that worldview. Right, he's literally floating up from, you know, and going through the hatch door. Yeah, like, well, yeah, maybe a little bit of the astronomy we learned, you know, and during the Enlightenment would have been, you know, helpful to add there. Yeah. All right. We're here.
To become fetishes, words had to be considered inspired. And the invocation of supposed divinely inspired writings led directly to the establishment of the authority of the church, while the evolution of civil forms led to the fruition of the authority of the state.
Yeah, see, like I told you. So now it's full on there that you've got these two parallel tracks. And we already talked about, you know, the inspired thing. It's... In an evolutionary sense, it's very important that we think about the words of the founding fathers of this nation, you know, in that basically that fetishistic way that we do, like they're talking about. It leads to the authority of the state. You know, there has to be something that in an evolutionary sense drives humans to surrender some of their sovereignty to the state, you know, for the greater good. What the Urantia book is saying, it's not that that was bad, but it's now time for people to, you know, to think about the founding fathers and what they wrote in a less fetishistic way. You still want to hold on tightly to the truths that they recognized and founded the nation relative to. But just, you know, take away that tendency to start thinking about the state in effectively religious terms. And we've talked about, I've brought this up many times, I mean, a simple example of how this works, you know, so they italicized authority in both those, authority of the church and authority of the state. There's this strong tendency you know, let's just pick on the office of the presidency for simplicity's sake. For us to think in this mode, where we want the government to be a religion of authority, and we want, let's say, the president to be that ecclesiastical authority. For instance, we want him to be, a moral authority. You know, because remember, in terms of evolutionary religion, that's basically what you kind of mean by religion is morality.
Well, we're not getting that one.
Okay. Well, and I want you to think about, how it. One of the reasons why, I mean, when we were talking about government. You know, we talked about this. You know, they specifically talked about how the chief executive, right, is not to be thought of as a high priest. Right? You're voting for president. The chief executive the chief of the executive branch. You're not voting for the high priest. You're not voting for the moral authority.
Is that the high priest these days?
Well, I mean, that's right. We all know there's problems with that. But, if there's problems with the priests, right, the church is saying, yeah, if we don't fix this problem with the priests, people are not going to think of us as a moral authority. See, and that's the whole point. Right? And one of the reasons why humans have gotten into this mode where they don't think about the president as properly, he's supposed to be a person who is, very adept at material pragmatism, right? So he can run this very complex corporation, basically. But the political operatives on both sides of the political divide have gotten the voters to think of, the president or other, public officials, elected public officials, in this religious mode, because this is the tactic they use to eliminate the opponent. Right, the political operatives on one side of the line try to get the candidate on the other side of the line to drop out by saying, "Look at he." He's not a moral standard bearer, right? And usually it works because we take this so seriously. The person doesn't have to be forced out. They drop out. They have such shame that they're not, that they're immoral, that they drop out. This is the tactic. And the political operatives on both sides want to keep you convinced that you're voting for the high priest. Because if you don't think of it that way, they can't use that tactic to eliminate the opponent. It's part of the scheme. So if you're going to transcend being a helpless victim of political operatives, you've got to stop thinking of anyone, that you're electing to the state, as a high priest, the moral, authority. The moment you start, think about how many people complain about the separation of church and state. It's like, well, right there is blurring church and state together. The moment you think that, when someone says, well, yeah, that person should be, a moral standard bearer, you've just blurred church and state. This is a country founded on the separation, right? I mean, we elect, in a Christian mode, we elect sinners, not saints. And we say we're all sinners. Right? You can't get into that mode where you think what you're supposed to be electing is a saint. That's, you're not keeping church and state properly separated. Right? So just notice how you've been manipulated into that in blurring the lines. Right? It doesn't mean that you have no you know, boundary lines about this, obviously. Okay, but just avoid that tendency of, you know, thinking that, well, because this person, you know, is not politically correct, or he just violated the mores, you know, he shouldn't even be allowed to you know, run as a candidate for the next president. I mean, Gary Hart just needs to drop out and shame, you know. That's the tactic, right? Because everyone's, you know, the political option would say, see, Gary Hart's not the high priest. He should drop out. And Gary Hart says, yeah, you're right. Okay, I just got to drop out. See, that's the, you know, and it's not proper. We shouldn't be doing it that way. We have to keep, you know, we believe that our moral compass is within us, that we have a second cosmic intuition. This country is founded on individuals who have spiritualized minds with a second cosmic intuition, a moral discrimination, right? The moral compass is not on the outside, and he's certainly not one of the elected officials of the government. Okay? That's not a proper way to think. You know, we don't live in the theocracy of Iran. Right? And we got to get back to that. We've slipped, and we've been manipulated into a lot of that slippage, because it's a powerful tactic to invoke, you know, this religion of authority mode, you know, to attack your political opponents. I mean, it's so much more powerful than making a policy argument, a science argument. You know, you want the sixth adjutant to be in there, not the fourth adjutant. Okay, I mean, if you want to get rid of your political opponent, now forget about the fourth adjutant. You want the sixth. We've been played into that. We need to stop being played like that. Anyway, I'll get off my soapbox. But we'll see if we can read totemism here, because it fits in properly. But I wanted to stress that a little bit, because, you know, they've got authority italicized twice there. It's a very important thing that they're bringing in. Again, why the book is here. It's another reason why there's a civilizational emergency, because we're polluting government with evolutionary religion. Okay? all right.
3, totemism. Fetishism ran through all the primitive cults, from the earliest belief in sacred stones through idolatry, cannibalism, and nature worship to totemism.
Okay, so that's kind of a interesting little sweeping short little statement paragraph. We need to see what they're getting at there. We'll see in the next paragraph why they're saying that there's this totemism is bringing in a new complexification of this phenomenon.
Totemism is a combination of social and religious observances. Originally, it was thought that respect for the totem animal of supposed biologic origin ensured the food supply. Totems were at one and the same time symbols of the group and their god. Such a god was the clan personified. Totemism was one phase of the attempted socialization of otherwise personal religion. The totem eventually evolved into the flag, or national symbol, of the various modern peoples.
So do you see? That's what the complexification is. It's just what I was just talking about. The tendency to not have two parallel tracks of authority, for whatever reason, but to have them blurred together. Totemism is an influence in our past where, see, it's a combination of social and religious observances, like they say in the beginning. And that just exacerbates this problem of not keeping it separate, right? And, you know, so your flag becomes a fetish object. Okay? It's not that there shouldn't be respect for the flag. Can you figure out how to respect the flag, you know, in a way that's not fetishistic? Good luck. You've never seen it. all you've ever seen is fetishism.
Luck
indeed. Okay, as they're about to point out. And see, that's what they're challenging you to try to think about. Huh, I never even thought about that. I didn't think I had any relationship to totemism. Isn't that like totem poles? And these are the people of the beaver, and these are the people of the deer. And they literally thought that they're, you know, the original person of the tribe was a beaver or whatever. You know, and there's really no difference between animals and humans and all that sort of stuff. No, it's more sophisticated than that. You know, and it's kind of insidious, like they're pointing out, because it just exacerbates this blurring of the line, and bringing the sixth adjutant into play with ideas instead of appropriately, you know, keeping it focused just on ideals, like governmental ideas. Getting juiced up by the religious impulse, when really that stuff should be about, you know, the spirit of knowledge, not the spirit of worship. Okay, there's a science to government; it's not a religion. Okay.
A fetish bag, a medicine bag, was a pouch containing a reputable assortment of ghost impregnated articles. And the medicine man of old never allowed his bag, the symbol of his power, to touch the ground. Civilized peoples in the 20th century see to it that their flags, emblems of national consciousness, likewise never touch the ground.
And again, it doesn't mean you shouldn't respect the flag, but you know, how do we respect it, you know, apart from it? Well, it's really the totem bag. See, the spirit of the nation doesn't literally possess that flag. You should be able to have a respect for the flag and not be so simple-minded about it, you know, where you're thinking so literally fetishistically like that. But, you know, we all know just how much reverence, you know, we put into a ceremony at Arlington National Cemetery, say.
Of course, in the Vietnam War, we were
burning. right, and yeah. The actual degree to which some people, you know, in the past have kind of, wait a minute, this is all just silly evolutionary religion fetishism and stuff. You know, then they swing all the way to the other end, right? And that's what I'm saying. You need to respect, the flag and the founding fathers, etc., but just don't think about it fetishistically. And the more fetishistically you think about George Washington, the more you're going to want to tear down every one of his monuments. Because he wasn't a saint. We certainly need to get him off the dollar bill. Notice how much we're starting to think that way again. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
The insignia of priestly and kingly office were eventually regarded as fetishes, and the fetish of the state supreme has passed through many stages of development, from clans to tribes, from
suzerainty
to sovereignty, from totems to flags. Fetish kings have ruled by divine right, and many other forms of government have obtained. Men have also made a fetish of democracy, the exaltation and adoration of the common man's ideas when collectively called public opinion. One man's opinion, when taken by itself, is not regarded as worth much, but when many men are collectively functioning as a democracy, this same mediocre judgment is held to be the arbiter of justice and the standard of righteousness.
Because somehow mystically, when it's a group thing, right, God possesses the group, and it's divine. Right, and that false exaltation of democracy, you know, even leads, you know, people who have a bias to their unity consciousness, who are interested in government, to translate that over, and religiously, they start thinking of religion in terms of collective salvation. instead of individual salvation. Because see, again, they, you know, see, so yeah, it goes from religion over to government, and then it starts to feed back over to religion again, right? And then the two just start blurring together. This is a hugely problematic thing that has completely corrupted our political process now. we are in deep, deep problems here with this. We've got everything so blurred together. That's what they're basically pointing out between the lines. It's like, well, you know, the spirit of your blurring is the spirit of totemism. That's the kind of the historical predicate. One little technical thing in there, because, we don't hear the term very often, suzerainty, in contrast to sovereignty. What are they getting? I got the clans and tribes and totems to flags, but what's this suzerainty to sovereignty? For instance, a suzerain state is technically a state that is dominant over a semi-autonomous, region. In other words, the power innate in suzerainty is relational. But the power innate in sovereignty stands by itself. Right? It's not, doesn't involve relationship to others. Right? It's innate, standalone power. Okay? So see, that's the evolution that they're talking about there. You can see how sovereignty is very important, but it could easily be overplayed, right, and become very absolutist, very totally possessed by the power of God, right? They mentioned the divine right, issue and stuff in there as well. And that's just reminding you, just like with the Pope, thinking of him in literal fetishistic terms, a divine right king, right? I mean, you're not thinking that God just, tipped his hat the king's direction. You're thinking that literally God possesses the king. And you're not, you bow down before the king, not because he's the king, but he's the embodiment of God. That's why you bow down. Again, we've lost, the literalness. So when we see someone bow like that, it's like, well, that's silly. It's just Bob. Why are they bowing down? It's like, that tradition got started because it wasn't just Bob. It was God. And you always are going to bow before God. You're going to prostrate yourself before God. Okay. Again, it's the power of the literal thinking about fetishism. See, it allows you to understand why the traditions that we have came to be what they are, whether it's not letting the fat flag touch the ground or whatever it is. And why people who favor their unity consciousness say, that republic word, that sounds too scientific. I want a more religious word. I like democracy. Right? It's just like they're saying, they're thinking of that ideal as an idea. Yeah, and you have this blurring between science and religion. So there's just, there's so many things we could talk about that, need clarification in the way we talk about ourselves politically, what we think we're doing, what things we've let slip in under our radar and now govern our thoughts and behaviors. It's just nothing but errant fetishism or, at least Yeah, it's just evolutionary religion now. It's not the science of government anymore, let alone the philosophy of government overarching that science of government. You know, like the philosophy of the Declaration and the science of the Constitution. There's an awful lot of people, why do you need philosophy of the Declaration or the science of the Constitution? Just shove those things aside. We have religion. What else do we need? Right? More and more voices are putting that forward. They don't see any place for the Declaration or the Constitution. See, and it's because those are philosophy and science. They want it to be evolutionary religion. And they want a high priest to rule it.
Ignorance involved there, too.
Yeah. See, it begins with ignorance, of course. Right? You know, but the only, and you'll always have those who can't help but be somewhat ignorant. But the point is, you know, the problem is when the leaders are ignorant, so that they can't guide the masses in a wise way anymore, right? If the leaders start treating it as a religion, right, then you know, all those that you know have been convinced it's a religion of authority will follow that authority figure and treat it as a religion, you know. And everything will just blow up then, right? It's impossible then, right? I mean, there's no way you can have a Congress if it's a religion. Religions are absolutist, right? You can't have politics, technically. Politics is about compromise. Is religion about compromise? You know, not in general. Some of the founding people like Peter or Paul, especially Paul, you know, might have been compromising and things, right? But once it's past them, you know, it's the word of God, and, you know, it's absolutist. There's, you know, you don't think about compromise. That's why Congress doesn't work anymore, because it's not a science anymore. It's a religion. So you're never going to get anything done anymore. Yeah. We got, you know, we're just very confused.
Pontificate.
Right. You know, and of course, not surprisingly, once it's kind of been totally expunged of its scientific integrity and it's just an evolutionary religion, don't be surprised if all the politicians start using the word moral again, like they are now. Right? You know, and they'll say, that science stuff, forget about science and facts. That's not important. The important thing is whether or not you're morally right. Right? You got politicians literally saying that verbatim now, right? You know, we've lost it. All right. I hope I didn't pound that too much, but it's, you know, you know, I mean, you're not going to get anything from this reading about fetishism and totemism if you're just thinking historically. Right. You're not getting to the truth. So you don't see the relevancy today. See, and it's like nothing but relevant. Everything that we've just been reading in this whole paper is just, it's telling us why there's a civilizational emergency. Right. We either haven't gotten out of the old fetishism wineskin, or we've fallen back into it. Okay. All right. So that's a great place to stop, because now we have the other issue that we'll get into next time, that whole fact of just magic, you know, in and of itself that we need to address.
I'll bring my cards.
Yes. All right. Let's take a moment here, everyone.